I'm getting closer to the facts. I've turned my back on silly dreams. I'm walking down that lonely road, and my heavy load, I didn't bother to bring it. When the sun shines down on me, I feel like I deserve it. When the sun shines down, I'm hiding out where you can't see, behind a wall, in the back of the room. I'm crawling slowly through the dark, I'm on it, and I'm getting closer to a hope that I can carry and take home with me. When the sun shines down on me, I feel like I have to earn it.
Rest in peace, Daniel Johnston, Eddie Money, and Rick Ocasek. Just a few blocks away from Box Cab Co. in the Bayview neighborhood of San Francisco, I'm Schmitty, and this is Talkin' Schmidt. Today on the show is the legendary Carl Watson. Carl grew up skating in San Francisco, and he was one of the first riders on Think skateboards and had an early presence throughout the EMB era. Carl has been on a few companies throughout the years, and today is part owner of the skateboard brand Max Allure. This past year, he came out with a children's book entitled My First Skateboard and was blown away by the industry support.
I did not think I was going to get the support from the core that I did, like, because, you know, the main characters have helmets, you know, it's a kid's book. You know? Like, I didn't think, like, quote unquote, real skaters were going to appreciate it. But I got the appreciation from everybody, you know, all walks of life.
Also, I really need to give a big shout out to yet another skate shop, Carrying the Schmidt. This time, it's Atlas Skate Shop in San Mateo, California.
Shout out.
And listen to this. Starting right now, the first person to buy a Talkin' Schmidt t-shirt from Atlas will win a free set of wheels. Head over to 209 2nd Avenue in Tim McKinney's hometown of San Mateo and tell him we sent ya. That's a free set of wheels to the first shirt purchase. Well, this is episode 38, and you guys are in for a treat.
This is Carl Watson, and you're listening to Talkin' Schmidt.
Here we go again.
It's cool, like tonight is the night.
Just give it the old college try right here.
Big dog's in.
Schmitty, what do you think, Schmitty?
96 times, Schmitty.
Thanks, Schmitty.
We on? Schmitty?
Talkin' Schmidt.
He's so fucking different.
Shit my pants, lad.
Your Rolodex is fucking deep.
Are you ready?
Come on, Schmidt.
Let's hear it for Greg Smith.
Actually, let's hear it from my next guest. We got a legend in the car right here. Carl Steven Watson.
What? Where'd you get that from?
Mad Circle Video.
I recognize the sound of it.
How you doing?
Doing great, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Fuck.
It's an honor.
When I started this podcast journey, I only dreamed that I would have someone like you on.
What?
For real.
Come on, man.
No. Everybody's about to just get super stoked right now because we're going to go through the history books a little bit.
Okay. I'm excited. Let's get it.
Where were you born?
I was born in Oakland, California, 1976, September 22nd at Kaiser.
At Kaiser. I was born Kaiser, Redwood City.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
I was raised in Oakland until I was 9. Then we moved to the city, and that's when I was introduced to skateboarding, the world of skateboarding.
And how'd that happen?
Being immersed in a different culture, because back then Oakland was totally different than the city. We came to the city and it was so free, so many different types of people, and skateboarding just like was a part of the atmosphere here, you know. Seeing people skate down the street and scare my mom was pretty funny, so that's what kind of got me into it, like the loud sounds. And the first time I saw somebody ollie up a curb was pretty eye-opening to me. The fact that you can bring the board up without grabbing it with your hands was it stoked me out.
Do you remember what your first skateboard was?
Yeah, you know, I had a Zorlac. It was a Zorlac green with white grip tape with OJ wheels and white tracker trucks.
Was it like a John Gibson or something? Craig Johnson?
I forgot the name. I was so stoked on it, I would like sleep with it. I would study every single mark that I made, you know, throughout the day, which was not much because I couldn't ollie yet. Yeah. You know, so yeah, it was, I cherished that board.
Rad. Who were the homies right there that you started skating with, like, at an early age?
An early age.
Like, was it your neighbors or?
It was, like, early on I skated with Nick Lockman. It was all him. Like, my mother, we lived in on Scott and Golden Gate in the city. Then we moved over to like near Stanion, like right by Golden Gate Park. Yep. Kind of a better area because, you know, I was hanging out with some roughnecks and, you know, they were getting caught up in some stuff, like stealing cars and selling drugs. So my mom was like, we're out of here. We're moving to a better area. So we moved by the park and I would use my skateboard to skate back to the old neighborhood. And one day in between, I saw Nick Lockman and he was like chilling in the window, bored. His dad was like standing behind him. He's like, "Hey, have that kid come in, see if he wants to hang out." So Nick was like, "Hey, do you want to come in?" I looked at him and I was like, "Sure, yeah." Then once I entered his house and his room, I realized that he had been a skater for a long time. He had tons of old boards around. He had all the skate videos, all the magazines,
wow,
all the Co's, the Jimmy Z's. He had, you know, he was a full blown skater.
How old were you around 12?
I was 11 and he was 8.
Oh.
And the trippy thing is a year before that, Nick and I met under different circumstances.
Oh.
So I was hanging out with that group of guys. We're on our bikes and I was just kind of like there, you know, not doing much. But the guys from my neighborhood were very aggressive. And so, you know, we had like a group of 9 guys riding around the streets. And, you know, they would always just heckle people and some dudes were breaking the cars, and I just kind of, you know, hung with them. You know, I didn't do much. I didn't say much. I just was there. So then one day I saw Nick and his friend, and I was 10 and he was 7. And I was with this group of guys, and they were skating a launch ramp right in front of Nick's house. And we were like, you know, kind of intrigued, like watching. Then Nick, he fell pretty hard. And I, you know, I was like a little prick at the time, and you know, I was small for the group of guys that I was hanging out with and a little younger. So I was like, oh, this is easy pickings. So I started laughing at him. And lo and behold, man, this little kid, you know, he grabbed his board and started approaching me like he was about to beat my ass with it.
Oh.
So he came up to me with the board and I was like, oh, no, this kid's about to beat me up and I'm going to be embarrassed in front of my friends because I didn't know how to fight. I didn't want to fight him, but I ticked little Nick off.
Yeah.
So Nick was, you know, he grew up in the hood, so he was, you know, he may have been small and white, but he was still like tough, you know, in a certain way.
Wow.
You know, and so he's approaching me, then his dad runs out and stops it. Thank God. I remember going to bed that night like, oh, thank you, Dad, for stopping that, because I would have been so embarrassed. Like this little short kid kicking my ass.
Oh, man.
You know, so then that's why his dad he recognized me a year later.
Okay.
And that's why he was like, okay, this kid has a skateboard now, he's alone, let's reconcile the situation, let's see what, you know, if you guys can be friends. And from that moment on, it changed the course of my life till this day.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. As people will learn that he's been in a lot of stages of your life, including the current one.
Oh, yeah. Dude, it's insane. It's insane. And I attribute it all to Nick and that monumental moment that changed my life forever.
Rad.
You know?
And was your first sponsor Think?
My first sponsor was Dogtown.
Oh.
1989. Me, Nick, and Sam were the AMs on that. So then, once that went out of business for the time.
Was that when Dogtown was in SF?
It was, yeah. Okay. So Red Dog was doing it
with
Keith Cochran.
Yep.
And they were like, you know, let's just put these kids on this new company, Think. And Think came about because they were going to call the company Move at first.
Uh-huh.
M-O-V-E. And Nick was like, that name's kind of lame. And he's only 8-9 years old at the time. So he's the one that came up with the name Think. He came up with the logo, the light bulb. He had it all dialed down and gave it to them, and they're like, we're gonna run with this.
That's amazing.
And that company lasted for years, you know.
Yeah,
I think a couple decades,
right?
So yeah, he was a visionary, you know. Still is.
Damn, that's amazing. So you were on Dogtown, and then you guys went to Think and started Think together with Sam, right? Or no?
I think Sam was on. No, I don't know if Sam was on Dogtown. It might have been just Nick and I,
but Sam went to Think, right?
Yeah, Sam did go to Think, but he was on briefly.
Okay.
Yeah, but Sam was on Dogtown. Yeah, I got the company's reverse.
Right.
So it was me, Nick, and Sam early on. Then Shamandoli, when we went on Think, he got on Think as well. And
Nick Diamond, right?
Yeah, he did get on Think. He did, but he was like an older guy, you know, tranny dude.
That was later?
Yeah, that was later.
Okay.
We were like the little groms of the group.
At that time, was Embarcadero going yet, or?
You know, it definitely was going at that time. I remember the first time Sam and Nick decided to bring me down. They had to, like, you know, they kind of vetted me for a while. They waited, you know, until I was ready. And it was a good year of hanging out with them before they brought me to EMB.
Really?
Like, I had to learn how to ollie first. I had to, like, you know, learn how to, like, learn the flow of a skate spot
uh-huh.
a little bit. So the first time I went there, I was so excited. I saw the stage. I had heard about it. I saw footage. And I tried an ollie, like freaking melon or indie grab off the stage. End up doing a nosedive and ended up on the ground just like in pain. Then Kelch, he walked over, picked me up by my collar, walked me over to the wave and sat me down. He's like, you'll be good, little homie. And that was it. Like, that was like, you know, I was accepted from that point on.
Wow.
Because I showed heart, you know, and then Kelch verified that I was brought in by Nick and Sam, but you know, like, everybody didn't get in.
Yeah,
you know, it didn't matter how good you were. It mattered, like, you know, how you carried yourself,
right? Who you were connected to, or how you like didn't stare after you landed a trick.
Oh my god, if you beamed, you're out.
You're done.
You're done.
Yeah,
you know, you had to act very stoic when you land your tricks. Like, you didn't care at all.
Let's talk about those EMB days. Who were the main dudes when you started skating there? Obviously, James was like the enforcer or whatever, right? And
yeah, you know, around that time it was Shelby Woods, was Rick Abaceta, of course, James Kelch, the THK crew, like Ryan and Thorne, those guys. Pierre was a big figure there. Let's see who else. Danny Sargent would skate there around that time too. And I don't know if people remember, but that Salapi on the middle stage he did back in the day was, till this day, is still mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
Just can't believe that.
So much rad shit happened there. Henry, too?
Henry, for sure. Henry, Carroll. I mean, they're the ones that innovated. You know, they really pushed skating to where it is today.
Once you got introduced to the spot, did it become a fixture in your life? Were you there a lot?
So once I started going to EMB, that was it. You know, I found my family. I found my friends. I found my community. It was a blessing, you know, like, to be accepted by that crew, to progress at EMB. There are so many things to skate, the stairs, the ledges, the curbs, the wave. There was a lot of amazing individuals that hung out there, you know. And it's funny because sometimes people, they say, like, man, you were so cool to me back in the day. Like, when I came to EMB, it's like sometimes I would see people like on the fringes of the spot, like scared to come in, and I would notice that. I would go up to them and like act like they were my homies, just so nobody would fuck with them. Like, hey guys, just come with me. Like, act like you know
me. The deal.
Like, yeah, you know. So But I was a little prick though back then. You know, I like to spitballs at people. I like to gleek on people.
Mazer, you know, told me that one. He's like, dude, that fool used to always spit the spitballs.
Oh man, I just like to get a rise out of folks, you know. But at the same time, I was very empathetic, and I did not like when I saw somebody feel out of place or uncomfortable at the skate spot. Like, that's not what I gained from skating, and that's not like I always saw skating as a family. And so if I saw somebody that felt left out of the family, like, I would always invite them in, no matter their skill level, no matter like their color, punk rock skater, rap skater, whatever it was back then.
Yeah,
I considered myself, and I wasn't like self-proclaimed, but it was like I felt like the a diplomat to skating.
Okay.
I felt like a diplomat to skateboarding because I was able to like talk to anybody, and you know, I felt connected to every skater no matter what.
How did you feel? I mean, obviously you saw some boards get ganked and some people get beat up, or how did that feel as feeling like a diplomat?
It was a lot of mixed feelings because sometimes I would just kind of turn the other way because I knew it was, you know, the person that is doing it needed the money, or they pretty much needed the money, you know. Or I would just go up and be like, hey, that's my homie. Like, if I saw it going down before it had already been done,
right?
Be like, hey, that's my homie. Like, hey, leave him alone. But I definitely knew my place, and I knew when to step in and when not to step in. And it wasn't like all the time, but it happened for sure. You know, like more so it was people getting cooked out of there. Like, cook, get the fuck out of here, man.
Yeah, you know? Just vibe. More than,
yeah, like if you didn't have the right vibe, nobody wanted you around.
Right.
You know?
What, I mean, this might be a tough question, but there's so much shit that's gone down there. Besides Danny's thing, what else sticks out as like, I'm sure you were on some of those LeVar sessions or like Mike and Henry, like anything that's like, dude, this day blew my mind.
Henry Sanchez, every single time he stepped on a board at EMB, he created a new trick. Mike Carroll, same thing. Javante Turner, watching him skate when I was younger, was incredible. Danny Way, one day he showed up there in the morning time with the H Street guys. He was skating the 7, fucking killing it, back 3, whatever, doing anything he wanted. And then out of nowhere, he broke his wrist. And I was like, hey, I'm from the city. I know where the hospitals are at. So I brought him over to Kaiser, not General Hospital. You know, I didn't know anything about insurance or anything like that. Brought him to Kaiser. He gave them a fake social and got his arm fixed for free.
That rules.
And I was like, man. And he was unfazed, man. He was ready to, you know, cast it up, ready to skate again.
Yeah.
You know, he had a certain energy that I had never seen at that point.
Uh-huh.
His drive, his ambition, his vigor, he just had so much energy, and he was ready to fucking go. That guy, you know, now he's, you know, fucking uber legend.
Yeah.
You know?
Him and Cardiel have those eyes of just like, they look right through you like, absolutely. I'm getting it.
Cardiel has the same thing.
Yeah.
Very similar.
That's sick.
It's just something you're born with, you know?
Yeah.
And your parents have to like really like feed it.
Were you there when Jamie Thomas came to town?
I was.
He was like, he would sleep there and stuff sometimes, right?
Yeah, it was at a weird time. At EMB, he came in really strong, super talented. You know, I think he didn't show like the right people the right amount of respect. And he was older, so he had to, you know, it was just hard for him to assimilate.
Right.
Because he was already so good.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't care. He didn't care what people thought about him.
Mm-hmm.
He just fucking came and did his thing. And, you know, he didn't have to kiss anybody's butt. But then, you know, of course, all the stuff that happened down the road was pretty catastrophic. You know, Tommy, he was always my favorite skater. And, like, it took a while for me to even, like, give him any respect after, like, that situation.
Mm.
Damn. But, you know, it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
But I was really bummed and really emotionally hurt by that situation because I could imagine how Tommy must have felt at that time. And he was, like, the epitome of skateboarding. You know, he was the first pro street skater ever. He's from SF.
Yeah.
I lived in his old apartment after him. I would get packages with his name on it. And I remember the first day we came to that apartment, 234B, Divisadero Street. It was a basement apartment. I walked in there with my mom. I walked into my room. And the only thing in the whole entire apartment was that little drum with the string and the little balls at the end. And, you know, you wiggle it in between your hands and, it, you know, it goes back and forth and hits the drum. That was the only thing that was in the apartment, and that was the same one that was from Animal Chin.
Animal Chin, no way.
And I remember sitting there, or standing there, holding it in my hand. It was wrapped. It had two Thrasher stickers wrapped around it, blue and white. And I just started doing it like that in my hand. I was like, one day I'm going to be a pro skater. I felt it. It wasn't something like I was like, I'm going to be a fucking pro skater. So sick. I'm going to be rich.
Uh-huh.
It was like, no. It was the spirits, the skate gods telling me like,
yeah,
this is your path. And I was a horrible skater at that time. I mean, I sucked, you know, and like, I had no reason to think I was going to ever going to be pro. But that's my experience, you know, 234B, you feel me?
Dude, that rules. Looking up to Tommy, I mean, we all did. Like, anyone that grew up in the Bay Area, Tommy, like, led the way for sure. And then you lived in his apartment after
him. Right after him. And the one thing that sucks, it was, like, end of the 80s into the early 90s. And that's when, like, Rip Grip was unpopular. We stopped using Rip Grip because we started doing nose slides.
Oh, yeah.
But before, you would put it under your, you know, under your board, and so you can grab it on top of your grip tape.
Yep.
So I would get all these packages of Rip Grip and just cherish it, but never could use it because skating was changing
right
at that point. So, yeah, I mean, I was super stoked to get it. But, yeah, I guess he never updated his address for his Rip Grip.
Damn.
He had no use for it himself.
They're still sending it there.
Yeah, right?
Did you ever skate Studio 43?
I did, man.
Really?
The Uber legend, Bryce Knights, bro.
Yeah.
That's where I met Tony Vitello. It was one night, a little skate session. And Fosto, of course, he brought him everywhere. Fosto, you know, nothing but love for that man.
Right.
Without him, street skating wouldn't be what it is. Straight up and down. I you know, he kept skating alive when it was dying out in the 80s.
Mm.
You know, he had so much love for it. He really, like him and a number of people, but, you know, he had the publication that really kept it alive.
Right.
And honestly, we got, you know, skating, it should always just be an ode to Fosto, modern day skating. So, but like he brought that night, man, he brought, it was like 6 p.m. to like 10 or something like that, like 4-hour session. It went into the night.
Uh-huh.
Tony was there. He was like 12 years old at the time, little kid. And no, maybe even younger. And so I paid attention to him the whole night. We skated and we hung out. And then a few months later, I saw Fosto at Think, and he was like, "Hey," he's like, "Yeah, you're the guy that got my kid into skating." And I was like, "Wait, what do you mean?" I was like, "You're Fosto, like you run skateboarding."
Uh-huh.
He's like, "Yeah, you hung out with him, man. You got my kid into skating." And I was like, "He's like, yeah, he was like you'll always be taken care of." He said that to me, and wow. I was like, "Fuck," like he wasn't joking either, man. He was very genuine, and I didn't really understand what he was talking about, but yeah, I guess like I hung out with Tony, and Tony like gained interest in skating after we spent time together.
Brad,
you know, I don't know if Tony has any recollection of that, but definitely I do, you know.
Hell yeah.
The boss coming up to you saying that, the guy that never really, you know, if he spoke to you, you listened.
Definitely.
Because he, you know, he was just so powerful, you know. So I was like, he was speaking to me in a happy way. I was like, "Yeah, look, check this out, homies."
Yeah, that's so sick. No, I bet Tony does have that in mind. Would you skate the mini ramp and stuff, or what was in there? A mini ramp and a vert ramp, right?
Yeah, but the mini ramp was like a vert ramp to me at the time. So I would like, I never dropped in, but I would pump up to the top. And I think the best trick I ever got on that was a rock to fakie.
Oh, okay.
And that's it.
Hell yeah. Did you skate the casting ponds at all, like, back then?
You know, and the ones in Golden Gate Park, right?
Yeah.
Not much. Uh-huh. But I don't know why. That spot is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that spot is amazing. But we did skate a lot of spots around the city, aside from EMB.
Were you skating during the Concrete Jungle era, or was it after that?
Ah, that's funny you say that. Concrete Jungle, man, that's... I think that's... I brought my old board there and got an Alva.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, "What the hell is this?" Like, it was like, you know, I guess they didn't really mess with Zorlac at that point.
Yeah.
So they're like, here's an Alpha board. Like, so they I didn't even have to pick my board out. They picked it out for me.
Yeah, Jake and Tommy worked there.
Oh, Tommy worked there?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I knew Jake did.
Yeah.
But it was, Concrete Jungle. I remember where it was. It was on Schrader, right? Like a few doors down where the old FTC used to be.
Yeah, like right. I think one's on Waller and the other's on Schrader, I believe.
Concrete Jungle or FTC?
I think FTC was on Schrader.
Yeah.
And I think Concrete Jungle was on Waller, okay. Like right around the corner.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. It was.
Yeah. Like behind Amoeba, kind of.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Dude.
Those are the days, huh?
Yeah, right? Like,
what a great name for a skate shop, too. Concrete Jungle. And they were as core as you can get.
Yeah.
I mean, now they were gnarly.
The singer from MDC ran it.
Oh.
So then, after Think, you went to Mad Circle?
After Think, I went to, I went to World.
Oh.
World Industries for a little bit. Okay, let me think about this. No, I went to Newdale after Think. Uh-huh. I wrote for Newdale for about a year. Then I quit Newdale to get back onto Think. Then after Think, I wrote for World Industries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so then the list goes on and on.
When did you meet Chico? At EMB?
I met Chico at Jack's Ramp. I was 13. And there was some footage that I posted recently that he pulled out the crates of he and I skating Jack's Ramp together.
Rad.
And yeah, little guy. We both had helmets on and fully padded.
Where was that ramp?
That was up in like Petrel Hill area, like on the east side of Bernal Hill.
Like in a little park or in a dead end or something?
Yeah, kind of like a dead end.
Tommy had a frontside air like an Indiana, right?
Yeah, and there's a nice view.
It was like a BMX ramp?
No, it was a skate ramp.
Oh, okay.
But I could be mistaken. I was so young.
Okay. Fuck.
It was awesome.
That's where you met Chico.
That's where I met Chico.
That's insane.
Super stoked.
Where'd you meet Chico? At a ramp.
At a ramp. Ramp session.
He was doing flat grab tricks on the flat bottom.
Oh, he was always such a gnarly tranny skater too. Like,
yeah.
Super smooth. And yeah, Chico kept to himself. He definitely had that vibe. Like he wasn't one to be fucked with.
Right.
You know, his energy was, he kind of demanded instant respect. Like you going to EMB, like nobody would mess with him because he like just kept to himself and he was very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had skills. So there's really no reason to mess with him. You know, he wasn't like trying to get people's attention. He was him.
Right.
Kind of like a very just solid dude, how he is today, you know.
Uh-huh.
Very solid guy.
Right around that time is kind of FTC forming. Those early days of FTC, like the video, what was it, Penal Code and that kind of stuff?
So FTC started out as a ski shop or something like that?
Oh, I'm not sure.
So it was on Bush and Golf, somewhere in that area.
Uh-huh.
It was about two blocks south of where the Whole Foods is on California and Golf right now.
Okay.
And it started off as like a ski shop. It was Lloyd's, Kent's father's store. Kent left, went to college, came back. He saw how skating was growing. He's like, you know, I skate. Dad, can we have a little section in our shop? So then, yeah, they started having like boards in the corner. And then skateboards took over the whole shop.
Wow.
Took over.
That's amazing. Did you film with Meza and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I filmed with Meza. Like I think it was Penal Code.
Uh-huh.
And that was a fun video because that was the first time we filmed like B-roll and like lifestyle stuff.
Yeah.
And it was like it was very impactful. People reacted to it well. It was done right.
The soundtrack was epic.
Yeah, all the slow-mo and just everything about it was really good.
And it was so SF, like with the trolley cars and stuff. Oh. Like that video, I know Meza well, but I always say, man, that video was maybe the best one impactful wise for me that he's done so many things, but that was a really good video for that time.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people bring that one up when they talk to me, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it was very impactful for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and it's just like he was using music for the first time to bring like those classic oldies kind of and just mixing it with Super 8 and all that stuff was like, whoa. Like it just was, he nailed it.
Good. What about Huff's part?
Yeah.
Ooh-wee, that song was banging. The skating was so good, so different from what we knew in SF, you know.
Right.
Very raw, very East Coast, very straight to the point. I'm not going to try a trick for a million hours. I'm just going to fly around some stuff and do some big ollies and look good on my board. And that was a unique approach for back then, especially EMB. We're always trying to like progress, you know, and be technical and learn new tricks and just, you know, enter. It was like a nebula for skateboarding. It was every day there was something, a new star, a new trick being born.
Yeah. What's like the gnarliest slam you've taken over all the years? Have you broken any bones or anything?
Definitely broke some bones, but the worst slam that I ever had was in Spain. We went to Mallorca Island,
mm-hmm.
and we stayed there for like a week. And there's this plaza there with like a little mini hubba. There's a pretty tall shootout ledge.
Yeah.
And it was our last day. I was there with Joe Brook and some other guys. Paul Shire was there too. I was trying to front nose on the out ledge, and we were going to be flying out that night back to Barcelona. And I was determined. I had been trying for about an hour, and it started getting dark. And I'm like, fuck, I got to get this. Like, I've already stuck it. It was about a 10 stair from my memory, if it serves me well, it was about a 10 stair shootout ledge. So pretty high. And so on one of the tries, I clipped going up, and I just ended up falling to my side, right? Then there was a ledge right directly at the bottom, and I like hit my leg on the ledge, and it propelled me straight to my head. Chipped my tooth. Oh. My tooth went through my lip. I got a gnarly scar in my eye, and I was knocked out cold. And it's weird because in the footage, I don't look like I'm knocked out. I'm like there,
uh-huh.
like but like a zombie. But I was gone until like we were heading to the hospital, like in the car. So it felt like maybe like 20 minutes. But then when I came back, I was like, I went to a different galaxy.
Whoa.
I literally went. I went to a different place. Like, that's how hard I hit my head.
Fuck.
And that was, you know, that was a brutal one because, you know, head trauma is nothing to mess with. And
did you have headaches for a while afterwards?
No headaches, but I did end up, you know, years later, they found like a tumor above my pineal gland, and they said it was from probably most likely like a really bad head injury that you had early on.
Oh, so it might have been related to that.
It might have been related to that.
Wow.
You know, so pretty fucking gnarly though, man. That was.
Yeah, that's heavy. How can we talk a little bit about that tumor?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, what was the process in dealing with that?
So it was 2010, Tampa Pro. I was right about to take my run, and it was practice. And, you know, I was just, you know, feeling good, feeling confident out there, going up to the wall, about to do a pivot to fakie. And fucking, it's so random that now I work with them. So Pete Eldridge, his board like shot out and hit me in the face super hard, and it just messed me up, you know. So went to the hospital, got a CAT scan. They wanted to see if my skull was broken.
Mm.
It was fractured in three places, and now you can start. Yeah, I can see like where it's fractured. Like sometimes if I don't have enough water, you can really tell how my face is like kind of distorted. It's pretty funny actually, because I'm just happy that I survived it, you know. And it's weird because I lost feeling from the left side of my face, like from my nose to my chin for 6 months because of it. It was pretty gnarly. But yeah, when I got the CAT scan, they found a small tumor on my pineal gland. And I came back, did all the tests, you know, did all the, you know, the MRIs, the ink in the blood. And they finally determined that it was a benign cyst after so many years. But this is after I opted out of brain surgery. Ooh. So I met up with this one surgeon at Stanford, and he was like, you know, very pompous dude and, you know, super wealthy, you can just tell. And like his attitude was like, yeah, we do 1,600 brain surgeries a year, and you're going to be the 1,601. Like, you know, just a very matter of fact, very cocky, you know, expensive suit. I just didn't feel right.
No.
I was like, man, this guy. And so I brought up my pineal gland. I had just read a book. It was called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And it talked all about how the pineal gland is so important to like the functions of our body, like our sleep patterns, like just so many different things. Yeah, after reading that and being sat there with him, I was like, hey, so what are you going to do about, since the tumor is right above my pineal gland, what are you going to do about that? He's like, oh, you know, and this is the straw that broke the camel's back. He's like, you know, we'll just take it out. It's pretty much your pineal gland's like your tailbone. There's no purpose for it. And I was like, oh, you said the wrong thing, bro. So I opted out of the surgery and didn't go back for a few years. Then when I finally went back, they kept wanting me to go back because they were concerned, you know, and I really appreciate that. So then we did more tests, and then they determined that it was a benign cyst, but it's still very dangerous, the location of it. Like, it can mess up a lot of stuff. And I do notice sometimes, like weird, like, mood swings. And, like, so I stopped eating sugar.
Oh.
And that really helps, like, to keep it small. Like, and sugar feeds it and makes it, like, grow rapidly, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, luckily, it wasn't cancerous. And, yeah, my mom, and she had the same thing when I was younger and had, like, a very invasive surgery. You know, lost all of her hair because of all the radiation, which was gnarly. My mom, you know, had, you know, such a beautiful lady, had such a big, beautiful, full head of hair when she was younger. You know, my dad, my grandfather is German. My mom, my grandmother is Ethiopian.
Wow.
And, you know, she was a great combination, beautiful head of hair. And fucking, she lost that. It was really hard for her being young woman.
Sure.
You know, and like having to go through that. And then, you know, you have a hole in the back of your head. They like cut her skull out. This is in the 70s. So it was very invasive.
Uh-huh.
So that was, you know, that my mom, she dealt with a lot just around that stuff.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, we thought it might have been hereditary, but, you know, it's hard to tell.
Fuck. Let's take a quick time out, hear from some of our peeps, and we'll be right back.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You are like one of the most like positive, happy-going person. You're always smiling. Like, what do you attribute that to?
I attribute that, like, my attitude, my personality to my mom. Like, so when I lived in Oakland, I lived with my dad and his lady and her kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I have, like, you know, I have stepbrothers. And so we, you know, we grew up in the typical Oakland environment. You know, it's like a little neighborhood. It felt like the South. A lot of church-going black folks. And, you know, and it was before all the thuggery of Oakland now. So it was very positive, but very, like, you know, contained to your little neighborhood.
Right.
So when I came to SF, my mom, when I turned 3, my mom came out the closet and said that she was gay. It's still a taboo topic with my dad. Like, they were high school sweethearts.
Yeah.
She left him. He was brokenhearted. Still kind of weird to even talk about it till this day.
Uh-huh.
And so my mom, she freaking, you know, moved to the city, you know, found a girlfriend. And after her surgeries and stuff, after she healed from the brain tumor, she was like, you know, I want my son to come live with me out here. And I was more than happy to, you know, like my dad, he's awesome, amazing man. Like, but at the time he was so busy, like working and, you know, always jogging or riding his bike. He was, you know, he had a ton of friends, so he was very social.
Yeah.
So I just spent a lot of time with my stepmom and her children, and, which was, you know, so different. I just had like a different outlook because of my mom. So when I moved to the city, to answer your question, my mom, like, she was such like a hippie and so open-minded, and that's what was attractive to my dad. He's like, yeah, she was they went to Oakland High, I met there. He's
sick.
Like, yeah, she would walk around in her sandals, and he was like, she was the only black hippie that I ever saw, and I loved that. So she was, you know, very open-minded. She had tons of like white friends, black friends, you know, guys, girls, gay friends, you know, whatever, just like everybody. And everybody was so fucking cool to me, you know, because everybody was, they were different. They're unique.
Yeah.
And like my mom would go around the city. She knew so many people. We would just take the bus around and she would say hi to everybody. They say hi to her. She would talk to homeless people. They knew her. She knew them. You know, she'd get their backstory. And she taught me early on, like, not to judge a book by its cover. They were all, you know, God's children, whatever. Like, not to like ever look down on somebody and just be joyful. And just having that instilled in me from an early age is to, you know, to like appreciate and, you know, talk to your fellow man, your fellow woman, whatever. It was very eye-opening. So yeah, like my personality, like my demeanor, like I attribute it to her. And also, like, when I turned 19, I really started branching out, reading certain books that opened my mind up to like really, like, really appreciate life and nature and just like the present moment. You know, because it's you can never go back, you can never go forward. We only live in the present, and that's why it's such a gift, and that's why they call it the present. So just being aware of such things like that, and I just like to smile, you know.
Do you do any meditating?
I used to a lot, especially like 19, like early 20s. I was really into that stuff. I was really into like Tibetan Buddhism. And that's around the time I stopped eating meat, and I started becoming like vegetarian, then vegan, you know, changing one thing at a time. Like I started, you know, switch from Crest toothpaste to like fluoride free toothpaste. And, you know, instead of like your typical soap to like healthier soap for the body, then lotion.
Just paying more attention.
Yeah, exactly. But it was like one by one, you know. But then it's funny because I was a vegan for 7 years, but bro, I was the worst vegan ever. I only ate vegan treats and soy products, no veggies, rarely ate veggies.
Oh.
And it was just like, you know, if it said vegan on it, I thought it was healthy, but it, you know, that was not it.
So you're not vegan to this day?
No, I eat I'm a pescatarian, so I eat fish, I eat cheese, I eat eggs, I do all that stuff, but I just don't eat red meat, no chicken, and no turkey. But you know, sometimes like I'll have a little slice to please my mom at Thanksgiving.
Out of all those books you read and stuff, if some kid's trying to get into, you know, living a better life and stuff, what is there one that stands out or a couple that stand out that you would recommend, like, you should read this, it'll really change your outlook on things?
Absolutely. The Celestine Prophecy was one.
Okay.
But I would recommend that like kind of down the road. But the one that really started my process was The Way of the Peaceful Warrior by Dan Millman. You know, what really related to me was the fact that he was a gymnast, and all of the things that he talks about, you know, that he talks about when it comes to gymnastics, I related it to skating. You know, so that book was awesome. I love that book. Living in the Light was another one that really opened my eyes up. And, you know, like The Alchemist, that's really good for a lot of people too.
Yeah.
But it was mainly like The Celestine Prophecy, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and Living in the Light.
You read a lot?
Yeah, I do. Like, one thing that's funny, because, you know, social media, like, it grabs your attention. So I went through a good 5 years where I didn't really read many books. And also, like, smoking weed.
Yeah.
Like, when I don't smoke, I read a lot.
Oh.
So, like, not smoking helps me, like,
focus.
Instead of, like, you know, at nighttime taking a puff of the joint.
Yeah.
Yeah, I go through waves. You know, I'll do that. But if I don't do that, I just read. So the last book I read was Shoe Dog, Phil Knight's memoirs, the creator of Nike.
Nike, yeah.
And that book was freaking eye-opening, incredibly eye-opening, and a great story. I love that book, you know. And I'm not even the biggest fan of the brand, you know, but that learning their story was really important. Now I'm reading Sneaker Wars.
Okay.
And that's the story of Adidas and Puma.
No way.
You know, so that's, you know, really important to me because I work with Adidas.
Sure.
I've always loved the brand.
Mm-hmm.
It was really important for me to learn the story, you know, of the brand. So, but before that, the book that really got me back into reading was a book called Deep Work.
Deep Work.
Such a good book. I recommend it to anybody, especially if you're like feeling sluggish or you have a lack of motivation.
Yeah.
This book really kicks your ass and gets you back to where you need to be.
Okay.
Like, yeah, this book was the one that was a catalyst to like get me back on my board, like fully, not you know, eating less sugar. I lost a lot of weight, and it really just made me prioritize like what's important to me. So yeah, Deep Work. That's a good one. Check it out.
I think I'm going to put that on deck for me. When you read, do you read books or do you read like off a Kindle or do you do audiobooks? Or
man, the day I have to read off a Kindle, bro, that's going to be a very sad day.
Yeah.
You know, I don't hate on anybody that does it, but man, I like a tangible book.
I
have a huge library at the house.
Oh, yeah.
I love the book. I love the smell of it. I love how you do the rabbit ears.
Yeah.
You know, the Kindle, it just seems so bland to me. Weird about, like, you know, digital content, because I feel like they can alter whatever they want at any time when it comes. Not, and they is very vague, you know, in quotes, they.
Yeah.
You know, I trust a book more than a digital format of a book, because I feel like the content is going to be more original and you can't tamper with it.
Yeah, I've been doing the audiobooks in the car, like when I drive like to LA or something. It's kind of sick. You can have like 8 hours in the car. It's almost like listening to a podcast, but you just listen to a book.
I need to do that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And you can get certain books have like epic readers, like Daniel Day-Lewis is reading this one or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I need to get more involved in that because, yeah, I sit in traffic a ton. So
yeah, like that kind of stuff. But that's a perfect segue, though, to your book.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
Yes.
First skateboard.
My first skateboard, bro.
Mm-hmm.
That is the best trick I've ever done. Putting that book out.
How did it come about? How long were you thinking about doing it? Like, let's hear.
Well, it came like honestly, like being hungry and being like, you know, forced to think of things, you know, ways to survive it's important. Like when all these young men, you know, I just want to like let you guys know when you're down and out and when you're like struggling to make it, you know, the ideas, like really dig deep and find ways out of it, because the ideas that you come up with during that time can be golden because you're hungry. You really want it, you know? So when I came up with the idea to write my first skateboard, it wasn't because I wanted money. It was because I felt like skateboarding was going in a different direction with the Olympics.
Yeah.
And I felt like the camaraderie was slipping away. So it came at a time when, you know, after Organica, I was kind of in a weird position. You know, I was working for this closet designing company, so I was very busy with that, going to all these rich folks' houses, building out their closets, and you know, making them very happy. I loved the job. Coming back into skating was, you know, I never left in my mind, but you know, I had to find work outside of skating.
Yeah, pay the bills.
And I was not, you know, I wasn't afraid of that at all, because you know, I have kids, and you gotta do what you gotta do.
Absolutely.
So during that time, I was like, man, how can I create something that embodies everything that I've gained from skating? I just wrote down all the things that I benefited me, that benefited my friends in skateboarding. And then I just had these key attributes written down and in my mind. Then after that, the story came so easy, because it was like I knew what I wanted to write about. I knew what I had gained, and I really wanted to point these certain things out to share with the world, just in case I couldn't continue to share myself.
Yeah.
You know?
So was it a pretty quick process once you kind of had it laid out?
Hell no, man. So the first thing is, my first skateboard started off as a screenplay, because I was like studying how to write screenplays at the time. And like, So it started off as a screenplay, and the story itself was way longer. Yeah, I you know, hit up Henry Jones, the illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, man, like let's I want you to illustrate this book. So he sat on it for about a good 8 months, and he's like, man, he didn't know how to tell me, but he finally told me. He's like, yeah, Carl, there's too much dialogue. Like, I can't illustrate this. So I was like, you know what? Thanks for letting me know. Let me go back to the drawing board. Let me simplify it. And I read the story, went and created it page by page. You know, like, it was way easier to do this. But then after that, you know, it took about a good year for it to come out, because I was trying to find publishers. Nobody was biting. I was telling my stories like, yeah, you know, pro skater, like I've been skating for ever since I was a kid. You know, there's something here. And not just because of who I am, but just the story was good.
Sure.
You know, what I felt like it would resonate with a lot of skaters. It would get people more into skating too.
Yeah.
You know, at a young age. So I was like, man, after getting turned down, you know, one after another, getting to run around, I was like, you know what, F it. I'm going to save the money, and I'm going to self-publish myself.
Oh.
So I saved the money. I think I bought like 3,000 copies. And man, when I released that, it went off like wildfire.
Yeah.
It was insane.
Support.
I did not think I was going to get the support from the core that I did, and still to this day I'm getting. Like, because, you know, the main characters have helmets. You know, it's a kid's book. You know? Like, I didn't think, like, quote-unquote real skaters were going to appreciate it. But I got the appreciation from everybody, you know, all walks of life.
Oh, so, it's so like, cool. Yeah, we just bought like four of them in Austin at No Comply.
That's so sick, man. Yeah, Elias there, man, No Comply.
Shout out.
He's a legend. He's one of the guys that really, like, killed it at Pier 7 back in the day.
Mm.
One trick that comes to mind that he did up the block was switch front blunt, switch shove it out.
Yep.
That was mind-blowing at the time. That was so ahead of the curve. Like, yeah, Elias, kill it, dog.
Elias, for shit.
Thanks for the support on the book, too. Appreciate it.
Shout out.
Talk about the illustrator.
Oh, Henry Jones, man.
Yeah, for those that don't know.
Henry Jones is a unique guy. Like, he's from the East Coast. He's you know, very educated dude, super quiet, and you know, really easy to work with. And so I saw a piece about him on the Barracks, and I just, like, you know, gave like a little backstory about him. And I was like, dude, I really like this guy. So I hit him up.
Was he doing skateboard graphics?
He had, at that point, he had done something for like Skate Mafia.
Yeah, Wes Kramer.
Yeah, exactly. I should have known that. I did the symbol, guys. Yeah, he had done something for them. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think my first skateboard has been is like the biggest one that paid off for him. You know, he got a good deal. Mm. I take care of him.
Rad.
He's happy.
Sick. Where can people, like obviously at skate shops, at the good ones, they probably have them, but if they want to get them like online or something, is there a website or something? Or
yeah, you can go to myfirstskateboardthebook.com and we ship around the whole world. We have books in English and Spanish, and we also have mini decks for the new up-and-coming rippers in your family.
Rad.
And yeah, you know, right now at the moment though, we're working on a cartoon series based off the book.
Huh.
So we hope to, you know, have that shown to the world within a couple of years.
Fuck, that's sick. So you think you'll do another book at some point?
You know, I want to do another book, but I don't know if it's going to be rooted in skating.
Uh-huh.
I just don't want to double dip. I feel like this got my point across.
Yeah.
You know, and it really embodies everything that I wanted to share about how skating can benefit one's life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my next book is, I might write it. It's called, like on something on symbiosis.
Okay.
So we can be more aware of like how important symbiotic relationships are in nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have that all in my head. So.
Do you think that you learned a lot from doing the first one that the second book would be a lot easier?
Oof, definitely. I learned a lot about Photoshop, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
I learned a lot about formatting. I learned a lot about dealing with your printer out in China or Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned a lot during that process. It was all me, you know, aside from Henry doing the drawings.
Yeah.
He didn't really know how to do any of the stuff, like the formatting,
the
Photoshop himself. But yeah. I did it all. I can't believe, like, it came out so good, honestly.
Dude, yeah, it's sick. Yeah, like I said, we got a few. And anytime it's, like, some kid's birthday or something, we know the present. We're getting another
book. That's so rad.
Yeah, thank absolutely. You, for sure.
You're awesome, dog.
What's up with Max Allure?
Oh, Max Allure is it's a brand that me and Nick Lockman, my childhood friend, yeah. The person that got me into skating, started. So after he left, left DGK, he was kind of in limbo, still wanted to work in skating. So we started Max Allure. And it was only natural to put guys on that were kind of a part of our story. So Nick got me into skating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he introduced me to the world of skating. I got Tafari his first board when he was 4 years old. Then in turn, Tafari got little Dre his first board when he was like 7.
Whoa.
Then when it comes to Jonathan Perez, I was living in Richmond at the time, and I saw him and his homie at a bus stop. I was going to pick my son up from school, and they had some janky boards, you know. And I looped around, went to the house, got some good stuff for him, some real boards.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I hope they're still at the bus stop. I hope they are. And they were. Hooked them up.
Sick.
Let them know where I lived at. He was only 12 at the time. Then, you know, we started hanging out more, brought him on, you know, a couple shoots.
Yeah.
And the kid just progressed so fast.
So much.
Started giving him Organica boards. Yeah, I mean, fucking now he's on Max Allure. He's, you know, soon to be pro for sure.
Rad.
It's a, you know, it's a continuation of the legacy of skating in San Francisco and the Bay Area. And like, you know, it's truly a family.
In one way or another, you've raised those kids. I've seen them at every stage of their life. In your car or at a skate spot. Like, Lil Dre, for sure, is the phenom. Like, holy shit. Remember that day we were, like, doing the firecrackers and he was, like, super little up at the City College? He was going down those stairs and he's like, hey, film this! And it was like me, you, Chico. I forget and why
my,
we're
my,
there.
And my son was there. Jai
yeah,
was
and
there.
Your son, yeah.
You did the no complies. Yeah. I remember that day. Yeah.
And then, like, he's grown. He's getting taller. Yeah. And he's just
mad
smooth.
Power.
He's got the sickest style. Like,
greatest trick selection.
Yeah. It's like, but I think if you asked him, he'd be like, yeah, Carl.
He probably wouldn't say that. You know, I think he's going to realize, like, when he gets a little bit older. He definitely gives me props, gives me love, you know, and. The you know, a lot of respect for sure.
Mm.
Like, it's funny, around that time, like, him and my oldest son, Elon, they became best friends.
Mm.
And, like, that's when the rat tail started, you know, it disappeared. That's when he started, like, dressing more, like, fashion.
Yeah.
Because my son was kind of into that. He gave Dre his first, like, I don't even know what the name of it, some fancy sweater. Then Dre just became a fashion icon.
A fashion icon.
You know, but he would stay at my house every weekend. you know, me and his father are hella cool. Dre's father and I have the same exact birthday.
Wow.
And he's like this thug Asian dude from fucking the TL.
Damn.
Full on me. He's like, he's no joke.
Really?
But it's still a hella cool guy, but he's not someone to be messed with. And Dre gets his toughness from his pops and his brothers. Like, I mean, it really crossed over. Like, and so Dre is definitely he's an alpha male.
Yeah.
For sure. He may be small, maybe, you know, still young, but that kid is, you know, I go to him for advice for certain things, you know, especially when it comes to graphics and like, so yeah, Dre's part owner.
Oh.
I'm part owner. Nick is part owner and Tafari.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, I included them in the deal.
Yep.
And, you know, now we're about to release our Double Rock. We have a little edit coming out. Got a name picked out. Pretty stoked in that.
Okay.
It's the Greek goddess for protection. And the reason why I picked the name is because skateboarding is going through a lot of flux right now. You know, we've been hit with a lot of traumatic experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, I felt like skating was immune to what we've been experiencing. So, like, I really felt like it's time to, like, kind of send the blessing to skateboarding again, like in my weird way. So Soteria is the name of the Greek goddess of protection. And it's like, you know, so when you usher in that Greek goddess Soteria, it like sends the spirit of protection to all. And so by calling our video that, all the guys that mess with it too, I'm, you know, subconsciously I'm sending that the spirit of protection to the community of skateboarders as a whole, so we can, you know, stop, you know, experiencing what we have been, and hopefully we can have that same, you know, nice run, you know, decade long run where nobody gets hurt.
Yeah.
Nobody's freaking dying, you know what I'm saying, getting hit by cars, like, because we deserve it. And I remember that time, so, you know, I think it takes somebody that experienced it, you know, that immunity to all these disasters to usher it back in. And get behind me, guys. We need the spirit of Soteria to go through the veins of skateboarders. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. So yeah, that's the name of the video, and
I like it.
Definitely, you know, because of my deep roots in skating and the love I have for all skateboarders, and how much I want to see us, you know, be protected and always see us on top. You know.
When's that gonna drop?
You know, I would say later on this year. I can't give a solid date, but definitely later on this year. The guys are killing it. The footage is amazing.
Rad.
And I'm just really proud of them, you know. And, you know, everybody's just taking ownership, which is great. We have a great team, you know. And I can't wait to share it with the world.
Sick, yeah. I look for that. Got to mention Ron Allen, because I interviewed Ron a little while ago, and he was so stoked that you had sent him some shoes.
No.
He was like, Carl Watson sent me shoes, and like, he was just hyped. And I was like, well, I'm going to be talking to Carl soon. And I just got to get your, like, what's Ron Allen mean to you?
That's crazy that Ron Allen is happy that I sent him shoes, because I mean, it's such an honor for me to do that. You know, like growing up, he wasn't like a Ray Barbie to me. Like, Ray Barbie was always on a pedestal, him and Tommy.
Yeah.
For sure. But Ron Allen was from the East Bay. I mean, pretty much he was a huge inspiration to me when it came to, like, starting your own company, being an African-American male.
Right.
Starting your own company and skating. Like, he really showed me that, hey, I can do this. And I can have people of all different colors on my team. And,
yeah,
you know, and it doesn't matter. We're skateboarders, you know. Mm. So, Ron Allen, bro. 8th Street, fuck. You know, one thing I remember from him, he's like, yeah, back in those days, I was bringing in like $10,000 a month off of board sales. And that always sat with me. I was like, man, that brother really did it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just like he was an average skater. He really was making money off of it. But, you know,
he made the music too. Like,
yeah,
he had a lot of, after I talked to him, I was like, dude, you did it. Like, you were like just as big as Ternansky. Like, you did all this other stuff. Like, it was
exactly,
it was pretty important what he did.
And yeah, you know, those early days, I can't even imagine the flack that Chuck and Ron had to face from their own community,
right?
Like, because it was gnarly being a black skater growing up, and then other, you know, people in the African-American community just like giving me so much flack for skating. It was insane. But the beautiful thing about it, and I don't know if all African-American skaters can relate to me, you know, I definitely from my area, you know, like growing up in the Bay Area, San Francisco, like that's why, like, man, honestly, like, I was embraced so much by white folks, you know, and like other people of other nationalities, because they didn't have that same, you know, chip on your shoulder about, like, you know, the whole race situation and stuff like that. They were more like welcoming, you know, like, yeah, I love all people, you know, but I just can't imagine what they had to face back then being black skaters.
Have you been paying attention to any of the ladies?
Are you kidding me, mate?
What?
Dude.
That's crazy. Paul Shire's computer just got stolen out of Chico Bernese's car.
That's crazy.
Hold on, guys. Break.
Yep.
And now for another First Impressions with Timothy Donald McKenney.
First impressions of the San Francisco legend Carl Watson. I can't believe I even get to do this right now. My first impression of Carl Watson is my first impression of San Francisco. Taking the train, the queer Freedom Rider train from Golden Gate Park with Justin Schnee, maybe 10, 9 years old. Taking that up and getting off, and there Carl Watson and with his buddy Jason. I think it was Jason. A couple years later, I ask him, does your buddy still skate? He says, no, he don't skate no more. They both ripped. We're sitting in a parking garage, skating, doing no complies, kickflips. I remember the yellow on the curbs. I remember just Carl ripping. And then I think we went to EMB. I think we ended up at EMB. But my first impression of Carl is San Francisco. My first impression of San Francisco. Dead ass. Shut up, I'm busy.
Hey, it's Corey at Blue Plate, 3218 Mission Street. Come see us. Meatloaf, fried chicken, deviled eggs, Dollar Olympia beers. We're here every day of the week. We got a garden, and we got smiles on our faces. Come let us make you happy.
This is Ron Allen, and you are listening to Talkin' Schmidt.
Shit, that was crazy. Fucking Paul Shire's laptop just got broken into, and Chico's car, which was right next to us, but I'm guaranteeing it happened before I got here. I would have seen the dude.
If we'd have seen that, we'd have chased him down.
Yeah.
Just giving them noogies until they give us the computer back.
Anybody coming to SF, don't leave anything visible in your car ever. It just isn't worth it. If you have to carry it into the restaurant with you, whatever you have to do, do it, because there are people that will just gank shit no matter where you are. It's insane. Now, I was just wondering if there's any girls out there that have been peeking, like you've been checking out, that are ripping, because they're making such a movement right now too, that like the women's skating is definitely growing, and there's like legitimate chicks out there killing it. And who sticks out to you?
Well, for one, I just want to point out that I've always been an advocate of female skateboarding, mm-hmm. ever since the EMB days, when they would get heckled like crazy, like do a lip slide, you know, whatever, you know, just some corny stuff. But I've always loved the fact that ladies were interested in skating, and now that they're finally being accepted and they're rising, they're ripping, they're fucking styling, they're getting good contracts, making money, it is like a blessing, bro. Especially coming from a family where my mom's a lesbian, and yeah, so I kind of have that, you know, I pump the fist for the ladies. Oh, you know, you know, am I, you know, not outwardly, but you know, whatever. Like,
sure.
So I think like Alexis Sablon, definitely have always been a fan of her. Mm. She's unique. She's smart. She's one of a kind. She has a lot of heart, bro. I've seen her take some falls, knock her tooth out, get back up and do the trick. You know, like the girl is no joke. And there's a number of amazing late young ladies. Nora, for example, she's amazing. I love them all.
Sick. Well, we got to wrap this up. I just want to give you a big shout out. Thank you so much for spending the time.
Thank you, Schmitty.
It's been an honor to have you in here, have you on my podcast. Worlds collide, but it's all for the love, skateboarding. I've been a big fan of yours, and I just really appreciate you.
Thank you, Schmitty. I'm honored to be on your show. Straight up, this has been a great conversation. And I look forward to doing more with you in the future.
Yeah.
Let's go film some lines.
Yeah, we got to film some lines. That's what we've been working on. We got to film a fire line.
Let's get it.
All right. Watch out for the Max Allure video later this year. If you are smart, you'll go out and buy at least 5 of his books. And keep your eye out, because we're out here doing it. So you're going to see us one way or the other. SFC represent.
Yeah, baby.
Big love, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Peace.
In this world of calamity, dirty looks and grudges and jealousy, and police where you abuse them authority. Media clowns when I know about variety. Boom, the youngest veteran I got murder them slow. Ragamuffin sent to call me from the bush bungalow. When I watch it make a clear road, my voice now figure out. Emerge from the darkness with me big blood to glow. Me yammer them a slam and spectator get low. Some boy could have big like Bam Bam Bigelow. Bust off trigger finger, trigger end and trigger toe. A two gun me have me bust them in a stereo. Cause I got to keep on walking on the road to Zion. We got to keep it burning on the road to Zion, man. Clean and pure meditation without a doubt. Don't make them take you like who them took out. Jah will be waiting there, we a shout. Jah will be waiting there. In this world of calamity, dirty looks and grudges and jealousy, and police where you abuse them authority. Media clowns when I know about variety. Single parents when need some charity. Youths when need some love and prosperity. Instead of broken dreams and tragedy, by any plan and any means and strategy. Say, you got to keep on walking, yeah. On the road to Zion, yeah.
Been waiting to do this track with you, man. Yeah, they know.
You got to keep on walking, yeah. On the road to Zion.
You gotta keep walking, y'all. Yeah, yeah, you gotta keep. Sometimes I can't help but feel helpless. I'm having daymares and daytime, wide awake, try to relate. This can't be happening like I'm in a dream while I'm walking. Cause what I'm seeing is haunting. Human beings like ghosts and zombies. President Mugabe holding guns to innocent bodies in Zimbabwe. They make John Pope seem godly, sacrilegious and blasphemous. In my lifetime, I look back at paths I walked, where savages fought and pastors taught. Prostitutes stomping high heel boots and badges scream at young black children. Stop or I will shoot. I look back at cook crack, plush cars that pass by, Jaguars, mad fly, and I'm guilty for materialism. Blacks are still up in the prison, trust that. So save me your sorries, I'm raising an army. Revolutionary warfare with Damian Marley. We sparking the irons, marching the Zion. You know how Nas be, NYC state of mind I'm in.
In this world of calamity, dirty looks and grudges and jealousy, and police where you abuse them authority. Media clowns when I know about variety. Boom, the youngest veteran I go murder them slow. Ragamuffin sent to call me from the bush bungalow. When I watch it make a clear road, my voice now figure out. Emerge from the darkness with me big blood to glow. Me yammer them a slam and spectator get low. Some boy could have big like Bam Bam Bigelow. Bust off trigger finger, trigger end and trigger toe. A two gun me have me bust them in a stereo. Cause I got to keep on walking on the road to Zion. We got to keep it burning on the road to Zion, man. Clean and pure meditation without a doubt. Don't make them take you like who them took out. Jah will be waiting there, we a shout. Jah will be waiting there. Clean and pure meditation without a doubt. Don't make them take you like who them took out. Jah will be waiting there, we a shout. Jah will be waiting there. Calamity, dirty looks and grudges and jealousy, and police where you abuse them authority. Media clowns when I know about variety. Single parents when need some charity. Youths when need some love and prosperity. Instead of broken dreams and tragedy, by any plan and any means and strategy. Instead of broken dreams and tragedy, youths when need some love and prosperity. Instead of broken dreams and tragedy, by any plan and any means and any strategy. Hey, say, you got to keep on walking on the road to Zion, man. You know, you got to keep on walking on the road to Zion, man.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talkin' Schmidt. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. When you subscribe, you'll get notifications every Tuesday of new episodes the minute they become available. Also, please leave reviews and a 5-star rating. It's the best way to help the show grow up them charts. All the episodes will always remain free to my listeners, but if you'd like to help support the show, you can do so at our website, talkinschmidt.com, where you can pick up some merchandise like stickers, beanies, t-shirts, or hats. The website has an entire archive of all the episodes with extra photos and video. You can also email me with any concerns, questions, suggestions, comments, etc. at talkinschmidt@gmail.com. That's talkinschmidt, talkinschmidt at gmail.com. All interviews are conducted, edited, and produced by me, Schmitty. The intro music is Mary's Cross by the band Nature, and a special shout out goes to my executive director, Cheryl Camisa.
Shout out.
Love it!
Until next week, this is Talkin' Schmidt, where the Rolodex is deep, but the conversation is deeper.
Talkin' Schmidt. Talkin' Schmidt. Talkin' Schmidt.